welcome to the Martian Driving Podcast 144. My name is Terry Frost, and this time it's vampires and virtual reality. To start with, I'm doing an Italian horror movie from 1960 called Playgirls and the Vampire, which is one of the first movies ever to combine horror and eroticism. And then we zip pan on to 1999. For a movie that came out at the same time as The Matrix, but wasn't quite as successful, though much more interesting from my point of view. And that is The 13th Floor, starring Craig Bianco, Gretchen Mol, and Vincent D'Onofrio. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we will get the show on the road. Martian Drive-In Podcast happens every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, fantasy, and horror appreciation. Sometimes I have guests in, sometimes I'll have a round table. Sometimes it's just random, particularly when there's a Netflix Marvel Cinematic Universe thing coming up. Feedback is the bread and butter of podcasting, so you can put feedback through at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can also email feedback to feedbackpaleo, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com. You can also support the podcast at patreon.com by going to patreon.com/paleocinema for as little as a dollar a week. Just be aware when you're listening to the podcast, there may be some naughty words in it. So if there are kids around, you might want to listen to it later on. Okay, so how has everybody been? I know there's been a hiatus, and I'll explain that in a moment. But before I do, good friend of the podcast and Patreon supporter Richard has complained about all the waffling I do at the start of the podcast. So just for you, Richard, go to the 15th minute of the podcast, and I'll start talking about the two movies. I know some people like the waffling at the start, some people don't. But I'm going to make an arbitrary mark at the 15-minute point to start talking about the two films. Okay, so that's dealt with. We've made everybody happy. And Richard, thank you for the beer because it was really nice. And I had that yesterday when I was recording an episode of Mike White's Projection Booth podcast, and it went down very well. What I've been doing is I spent 9 days in Sydney because a couple of reasons. One, I had to flat sit for my sister because they have a new cat and the new cat needed flat sitting. Plus, it gave me an opportunity to visit my mum in her nursing home where she's kind of living for the rest of her life because of her dementia. So I did that. My brother-in-law's mum was also in hospital, so I spent a bit of time visiting old ladies in hospital. So I did a bit of that. Plus, I did a lot of videoing for YouTube. I did a ton of that. I did one for Sculpture by the Sea. I'm going to post a link to the YouTube page so you can check that out. I did another one about revisiting my childhood, which turned in a really strange but positive direction while I was filming it, and I kind of enjoyed that one. I think it's the best one I've done from a personal point of view so far. I've got a couple of others that I've got the video for, but I haven't actually edited yet, so there'll be a few more of those kind of things up there. They're a bit like a travel vlog in a sense. But I also want to keep doing the movie-related YouTube things as well. So, yeah, I've been creative and productive as fuck lately. But it has kept me busy. And then we had a few things we needed to do this week, including a craft market Sally's currently attending while I record this. So, yeah, crazy, crazy busy, but in a positive way. We've also recorded two of the three episodes of the Projection Booth podcast that Mike White has, which we're doing about Raymond Chandler adaptations. The first one was about Farewell, My Lovely with Dick Powell. Second one was just about The Big Sleep. And we're still to record the one about the 1973 Robert Altman version of The Long Goodbye. So that's all going to be fun. Working with Mike and Eric Cohen is a lot of fun. We really kind of have a great time shooting the shit. And, you know, I throw in a little bit of gossip. I threw in some celebrity gossip in there, which Mike wasn't aware of, and it kind of sent him for a spin. But that's all fun. It really is enjoyable, and he's a great gent to work with. Really enjoying it. Also did a shit ton of exercise in Sydney. I didn't mention that. I did a ton of exercise. I did 120,000 steps in 9 days and 120 flights of stairs, which for somebody who's as naturally sedentary as I am, that was a lot of work. I got very sore doing it, but I want to kind of keep up that level of exercise and things because I want to be really fit for the Japan trip in April and really kind of keep that as a part of my life. Anyway, what have I been watching? That's probably the next thing to go into. A few things, because, of course, there's been a little bit of a gap in the podcast. I did go and see A Star Is Born, which is the fifth, I think, version of the original. The original was 1937. Then we have 1953, 1976. There's a Bollywood version from 2013. And there's this one with Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga from 2018. And it works. The whole plot is unashamedly a melodrama. It always has been for the last 81 years. But it works. The acting's fine. The direction's really good. The updating of the mental challenges that at least one of the characters has to undergo as a part of his life, oops, spoiler, has been updated for a more nuanced view on those things. And it works. It's got Sam Elliott in it as well, which is never a bad thing. There's very rarely been a bad movie with Sam Elliott in it, including Frogs. But you should check that one out if you haven't, because it may well be worth your while. It's definitely not my kind of movie as a rule. But I was in Sydney. It was my last day in Sydney of 9 days. And to be honest with you, being by myself most of the time, I was getting a bit lonely. Movies always help with that. So I went down to the big cinema complex. And I didn't know this, but a lot of cinemas these days have reclining chairs. Our local one doesn't, so I've been going to the local one a fair bit, but a lot of cinemas have reclining chairs now, and that's pretty cool, as long as I don't sit too far back, because if I sit too far back, I've got bifocals, and I'm looking through the near part of my glasses if I sit too far back on a reclining chair, and the screen's at a certain level. So I'm going to have to be careful and sit about halfway down the cinema, and it'll be a lot more kind of comfortable experience for me to use reclining chairs in the cinema. But yeah, you should check that one out if it's outside your normal wheelhouse, because I think it may well work for you. I did see one of the DC animations, I think, called Batman Ninja, which was made overwhelmingly by Japanese creators. It isn't like a cultural appropriation thing. The director, the designers, the voice people, everybody in it is Japanese. And Gorilla Grodd has a time machine, sends back Batman and a whole bunch of villains into medieval Japan, and they kind of play out a few years there. It's really interesting. It works kind of well. There's some really cool, what would you call it, bamboo punk kind of stuff there that that really did work. So you might want to check that one out. Visually, at least, it's incredibly interesting. And they do it in a whole bunch of different Japanese art styles. So if you're interested at all in kind of alternative takes on the Batman, you should see that one. If nothing else, it's an experiment and they're trying to get out of the box there. And all credit to them for that. So I saw that. As I said before, I watched Murder, My Sweet for the Projection Booth podcast with Mike White and Eric Cohen. And yeah, Dick Powell, great stuff. See that one. It's one of the great early films noir. And I enjoyed it a lot. I then saw another version of the same story, which is a movie with George Sanders in it called The Falcon Takes Over, which is a much lesser version of the story. Then I saw something I've been waiting decades to see, and it hasn't been available to me or pretty much anyone else on this clay and granite planet until now. And that is The Other Side of the Wind, Orson Welles' last movie, which has been reassembled with a bit of assistance from Netflix, put together. And yeah, I'm going to talk about it in the next Paleo Cinema podcast, so I don't want to take away all of the oxygen from that. Complex film in some ways, unlike a lot of other films, and incredibly unlike any other Orson Welles film. So if you're interested in seeing The Other Side of the Wind, you can see it first and then listen to the podcast, which I probably recommend because there will be spoilers. And I've waited for it, and I'm going to see it again before next week, and my initial kind of impressions are it didn't disappoint me. And then I saw a documentary about it called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, which is about Orson Welles and the career and how The Other Side of the Wind got made and then got fucked up by, amongst other things, the Iranian Revolution. Very complicated story, but quite interesting. And see that after you see the movie would be my advice on that one. Then I saw, just for a bit of bubblegum action stuff, Equalizer 2 with Denzel in it, And yeah, there's some great action sequences. Antoine Fuqua does some nice action sequences in this one. It's very much an over-the-top, outrageous action flick, which, and if you're in the mood for that kind of thing, definitely go for it. It's got some unusual settings. There are a couple of bits where I thought, yeah, that's a cool move. There's always the cool move bits in the Equalizer movies. So it's worth checking out for that. I think it made a lot of money, so, or at least some money, or enough to maybe generate a further sequel in that particular franchise. So it's worth checking out for that reason. And if you're in the mood for some good meathead action flicks. Then saw two more Raymond Chandler movies. The Big Sleep, of course, which I was doing with Mike and Eric. And with Bogart, Bacall, Martha Vickers, all those other people, Elijah Cook Jr.'s in there. And I've spoken about that on the Projection Booth, so watch the Projection Booth podcast, or listen to the Projection Booth podcast, and you'll hear everything we've got to say about that. Then I watched The Long Goodbye, which is the next movie that we're doing on the Projection Booth. I watched it a week early because I got confused. And with Elliot Gould, of course, Robert Altman movie, Sterling Hayden's in it, Nina Van Pallant, Arnie turns up in a non-speaking role. I'm going to wait until I do that for the podcast before I talk about it. Then I saw a really interesting, very, very small film from the late 1950s called The Big Operator, about union corruption, with Mickey Rooney, Steve Cochran, Mamie Van Doren's in there, Mel Torme gets set on fire. Going to talk about that in a future podcast because that's just a mad little flick. And you should check that one out, The Big Operator. I believe Olive Films have released it on digital format, and it's a little hidden gem. It really is kind of crazy in a lot of ways. Fairly small budget, but we'll talk about that in a future podcast because there's some cool things to say about that. Then I saw a movie from the 1980s based on a stage musical. It's called Zoot Suit, and it's got Edward James Olmos in it. Based on the Zoot Suit riots during World War II in Los Angeles. And it's good. I've halfway through rewatching that. I watched it once on television many moons ago. And I mean, I enjoy the fact that they keep the staginess of it in order to tell the story. That works for me. And it's, it's an interesting thing. It's a nice one to revisit, to see a young and not quite as gnarled Edward James Olmos just kind of owning the screen. So watch that. I've got about 2 more minutes to talk before Richard H. gets mad at me for going over time on that 15-minute limit that I put on there. I've been watching a bit of TV. I've been watching the new season of Legends of Tomorrow, which is a bit of fun. I've also been watching the new Sabrina the Teenage Witch thing on Netflix, which is actually enjoyable and a little grittier than the usual teen fare, which is kind of cool. I've also been watching the first few episodes of Titans, the Teen Titans live-action adaptation that's been done this year, and I like it. It's got, that brings in some really cool DC characters as secondary characters, apart from the Teen Titans. It's darker and edgier, and it kind of works for me. I like it a lot. It brings in people like Hawk and Dove, the superhero team from, I think, the 1970s that was in the comics, and then just to spin me out totally and completely and utterly, they bring in the Doom Patrol. Now, if you haven't heard about the Doom Patrol, do a quick Google. Pause the podcast and do a quick Google. They brought the fucking Doom Patrol into that series, and I'm there. I liked the Doom Patrol. I liked them when they came out, when they originally came out. And, I want to see more of them. Apparently, there is a series that they're developing for the Doom Patrol, and I'm welded onto that. I'm really going to go for it because I think it's a really cool superhero team. It shits on the X-Men as far as being dark and cool and psychologically complex. And it's going to be a lot of fun to kind of visit that and groove with it and see where it leads us. So anyway, heading up towards 15 minutes. So what I'm going to do, I don't have a trailer for The Playgirls and the Vampire. So I'm going to play some music from that time, some Italian music from that time, and then we'll get on talking about The Playgirls and the Vampire, a 1960 Italian horror movie, nothing to do with Mario Bava, but it's really interesting in a lot of ways, and it's got some cool aspects to it that I really wanted to talk about on the podcast. So here's that little bit of music, and then we'll get into the Playgirls and the Vampire. That was Diamond Bossa Nova by Francesco De Masi. So I thought I'd put that in there because it's very much 1960s Euro jet set vibe kind of music. So I went to the Playgirls and the Vampire. I've had this one for a while. I picked it up quite cheaply, I believe, from overseas. So it's an overseas pressing. I just thought I'd give it a go, a few bucks here and there. It's directed by a guy called Piero Rinaldi, who's an interesting guy because not only did he direct this horror slash lightly erotic movie, but he also ended up in future life becoming the movie critic for the Vatican newspaper L'Osservatore Romano. And why not? A guy's got to make a living, right? So, that's his story and his arc. Now, there's nobody really famous in this film. I'll kind of take you through the players in this, but as again, there's not anybody famously famous. A guy called Walter Brandy plays Count Gabor Canassi and the vampire. He's an interesting looking guy. He looks a bit more like he should be standing on the Via Veneto next to a sports car than sitting in a large Italian castle waiting for a bus full of beautiful women to turn up, which is indeed is what happens. I'll give you the plot outline from Wikipedia just to simplify things. A feckless troupe of European exotic dancers and their piano player, led by a bumbling manager, stumble upon a castle after encountering a ferocious storm. The castle, inhabited by Count Gabor, his assistant and a vampire, is little refuge for the travelling showgirls as they slowly fall under the spell of the undead demon. Vera, one of the reluctant dancers, is the living doppelganger of the vampire's dead wife, Margarita Canassi, who has been dead for 200 years. She becomes the object of affection for both Count Gabor and the vampire. So that's pretty much how it plays out. Not a terribly, terribly, terribly complex story, but it kind of works. I like the vibe of it as much as I like anything else. So this bus full of exotic dancers, piano player and really sleazy little manager turn up at the castle after being warned. They detour off the main road, but they get warned not to go near the castle by the local constabulary. Nonetheless, they do, because where else are they going to go? And they get accommodation from the count, who's quite nice and personable and has a kind of bouffant hairdo. Settle in, they get rooms for the night. They find a kind of large living area where they do a rehearsal, and it's pretty obvious pretty quickly that none of them can dance very well. And then Cartier does a strip tease, which is interrupted by the housekeeper, which is a bit of a bummer for the audience, but she doesn't do a bad job of the strip tease, to be honest with you. Nobody else can dance. But Cartier, played by Maria Giovannini, is quite adept at moving her body around. So they all settle in for the night, and they're warned not to leave their rooms at night, and pretty much everybody does, because nothing would happen in the movie if they didn't. And overnight, disaster strikes. Cartier is found outside the castle and appears to have fallen from her window. Now, we as the audience know that didn't happen. She got bitten by a vampire and then chucked out. But everybody else thinks so, and it's really sad. They can't get anybody to help with the burial or anything like that just yet because distance and all that kind of thing. So the members of the household bury Katya, and everybody's a bit sad for a while. But things, of course, are not what they appear to be. And there's a couple of things that happen. Vera decides to wander around because, you know, let's not worry about the fact that somebody just died in the place and you've been warned not to wander around at night time. She decides to and finds Katya's grave. And guess what? Katya's not in the grave. The grave's dug up. And so she's concerned about that. And then we find out that the Count actually has her on a slab and is doing scientific experiments with the corpse, which immediately kind of knocks him down a few grades as far as boyfriend material for Vera is. But it turns out that he's kind of benign in what he's doing. What he's trying to do is do experiments to cure vampirism because there's a vampire in the castle. Or otherwise, the movie wouldn't have been named what it's named. In fact, in Italy, the name for the movie translates as The Vampire's Last Victim, which is slightly spoilerish, but yeah, if you see a vampire movie, pretty much you know that at least one of the vampires is going to die somewhere along the lines. It's written into the contract if you're going to see a vampire movie. The other problem, of course, is that Katya gets off the slab and causes some ruckus. She goes and decides to pay a nocturnal visit to a friend of hers. The sleazy little manager, Lucas, played by Alfredo Rizzi, who is laying in his little bed reading a girly magazine. Now, here comes the interesting bit from me. She's in shadows and you can only just barely see her eyes. And then she steps forward and there's a full-on topless scene in a 1960 movie. Now, I know that there are European versions of various films done, but it's still a bit shocking to see a topless woman in a 1960 movie of any kind from anywhere. And that surprised me a little bit. And then I did a little bit of back research on it. And this is kind of a very, and I'm going to use this word advisedly, seminal movie in the kind of crossover between horror and eroticism. Yeah, there were things that kind of hinted at it. The Hammer Dracula remake, for instance, and things like Dracula's Daughter, there was always a little frisson there of eroticism along with the horror. And, of course, that goes back to the original 1931 version of Dracula, which wasn't the original version of Dracula, I know, but you know what I mean. So, but this one is like full-on erotic, and that is a kind of starting point for overt, let's say, eroticism in horror movies. And it then kind of snowballed from there, heading up towards Hammer horror at the end of the decade with things like The Vampire Lovers, Lust for a Vampire, Twins of Evil, and all those kind of films that I felt very fondly about when I was a very much younger man. So inevitably she bites Lucas in the neck. He doesn't die of it, but ends up a little bit enervated by it all. And then we get some further scenes which ultimately lead up to Vera confronting the vampire, who turns out to be the ancestor of the Count. They look identical, and there's some great fight scenes between the Count and his body double in that sense, Walter Brandy and his body double, which kind of work well because the body double does look a lot like him, so that's a big plus. But we get some scenes of Vera wandering around the castle again because, you know, they get told not to, but they wander around the castle endlessly while with her beehive hairdo and baby doll nighty, which is transparent. So we get some more kind of fairly overt nudity from Lila Rocco as she's wandering around the castle, inevitably gets attacked by the vampire, and the Count Gabor fights off the vampire and steals a little bit from the Hammer remake of Dracula, let's say, as a means of dispatching the vampire. And in dispatching the vampire, he does it with sunlight, basically. In dispatching the vampire, there's some really nice but very bad animation cell work to give us the impression of this disintegrating vampire. And I love it. I love the way they handled that disintegration of the vampire in this film. You really should see it because it's bad from a technical point of view, but it kind of, you get fond of it. You kind of go, okay, I see what they were trying to do there. I see they didn't have a hell of a lot of money. It only, you know, it didn't make a hell of a lot of money. It made like 72 million lire, which wasn't a lot of money in those days, even then. But I could see they were trying hard, and they're kind of, you got to give them some credit for that. They get props for not just having him kind of do a fade out, but showing that disintegration by some means, even if it's a quite a bad one, really does give them a tick from me. And I suppose movies like this, which combined horror, even if it was supernatural horror in this case, with eroticism, kind of led into the giallo movement in the 1960s with Bava's Blood and Black Lace and all the ones that followed that, having the combination of kind of erotica and horror and eventually evolving into sexual sadism as well, is something that started out with movies like The Playgirls and the Vampire and, of course, I Vampiri that Bava did around the same time. There's a kind of a loosening up of what they could show, and they just kind of went to town with it. And the Italian film industry was never the same again. But I enjoyed this one. I'm not sure how many more times I'll watch it because there are so many other things that has led me down the path of finding other movies. I have got a copy of Blood and Black Lace, which I'm going to watch really soon. So there's that. And there are a few other gialli that I really want to kind of get into. Giallo as a genre doesn't grab me for some reason. But I think if I watch a few more of them, it may become an acquired taste for me. So I can then kind of spin that off into some episodes in the future. But this one, because of the supernatural horror thing, and because it isn't so colourfully full on being in glorious black and white, was probably a good entry point for me to start looking at Italian exploitation films of that certain era from the 60s to the late 70s. And kind of going down that particular garden path. That's one of the problems. There is, you kind of watch a movie and you think, okay, I want to see more of that kind of movie. And then you realize that you've said that about 15 different other kinds of films, and you just simply don't have the time or the resources to follow all those little garden paths, which is one of the problems, of course, for us as film buffs, is there are so many things to see. I've got an enormous pile of DVDs, a lot of them with quality Asian cinema, sitting on my coffee table beside the TV, and I'm just kind of waiting to get through them. I've got to watch, let's see, Kiki's Delivery Service with Sal. I've got to watch Howl's Moving Castle with Sal. I've got to watch Quaidan again. And there's just so many of them that are sitting on that table. And they keep staring at me and going, you need to watch me. And then I don't. So I've got kind of an issue at the moment. But I will get through them. What I probably should do is go, okay, I'm not going to watch streaming stuff for a while. I'm going to hit the solid media. And I'm going to just watch the damn things, get them off that pile and into the back room on the shelves, and then I can relax for a little bit. It's going to be an enormous task because I did a while back that 13 movies in 24 hours thing for the YouTube channel, and it was an ordeal. You go back and watch it. I'll put the links to the channel in the show notes. But, yeah, I've really got to kind of do something about that. And I don't know what. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, I'm going to talk about a much more recent film from the end of the last century. And that is The 13th Floor, starring Craig Bianco, Gretchen Mol, and Vincent D'Onofrio. And I do have a trailer for that one.
On the 13th floor of a corporate tower, a team of scientists have created a portal to a simulated universe. Now, after 6 years of testing, they are about to cross the boundaries of reality.
So the whole thing's what, a giant computer game?
Nothing so mundane, man. When my mind is jacked in and I'm walking around experiencing 1937, my body stays here and kind of holds the consciousness of the program link unit.
They thought they could maintain control.
You can't just keep plugging your brain into this machine and not expect to be affected by it.
But once they opened the door...
Isn't this great?
These people are real.
Is this real?
The experiment turned on them.
You think one of them units crawled up the extension cord and killed its maker?
Then why didn't they kill you?
Maybe they will.
Saying that there's another world on top of this one?
That's right.
We're nothing but a simulation on some computer.
So who's in control?
Not us.
You could call it the end of the world.
There, even though it doesn't exist.
Hey, what'd you do to the world?
Turned it off.
And we're back, and The 13th Floor was a 1999 science fiction movie. It was directed by a guy called Joseph Rusnak, and it stars Craig Bierko, Gretchen Mol, Vincent D'Onofrio, and Armin Mueller-Stahl. Like I said, it's science fiction. It came out roughly the same time as The Matrix, and Craig Bierko, one of his interviews, complained that two movies came out about roughly the same subject, and he got the one that didn't have a special effects budget. But nonetheless, I find it a more interesting film than Matrix, which I think is very overrated. I mean, a lot of people disagree, and there were some groundbreaking special effects, and the Wachowskis did a whole bunch of really innovative stuff with it, but the story is pretty dumb and empty for me. We can disagree about that over a beer later. But in this one, in the late 1990s, a guy called Hannon Fuller, played by Mueller-Stahl, I'm kind of paraphrasing from Wikipedia here, owns a multi-billion-dollar computer enterprise and is the inventor of a virtual reality system with an entire simulation of 1937 Los Angeles. The simulation is filled with simulated humans who are themselves AIs. They believe they're real. They have internal lives. So basically the breakthrough here isn't the fact that he created a 1930s duplicate of Los Angeles. It's the fact that he created AI, but the movie doesn't seem to acknowledge that, as indeed didn't previous versions of it. Fuller kind of uses the AI to go back and sleep with women in the 1930s because you can jack into these virtual realities and it feels like you're living a real life, that you're really a part of that time period in the simulation. It's like any type of new technology, guys will find a way to sexualize it, and that's indeed what Fuller does. Now, Fuller gets murdered, and his protege Douglas Hall, played by Craig Bierko, who's also the heir to the company, becomes a prime suspect. They've got a police guy on the case, played by Dennis Haysbert, who's really good in this one. He does some nice bit of subtle acting in this. His name's Larry McBain. And along comes Jane Fuller, played by Gretchen Mol, who's the estranged daughter of Hannon Fuller and who's been overseas for a number of years. The other person associated with the VR experiment is a guy called Whitney, played by Vincent D'Onofrio. He is the tech guy. He's enthusiastic about the technology, as indeed is Douglas Hall. But he's kind of, you know, a little bit wary of the technology. Well, he's the one who knows the limits of it and who really doesn't want to take anybody who goes into the virtual reality too far, because there can be consequences on your brain structure. Because when you go into the simulation, the simulated AI who you jack into comes up to your reality. So Douglas goes down in the 1930s. The 1930s guy comes up to our universe and they keep him sedated, hopefully, so that he doesn't realise that he's living in a simulation and his whole life's a lie and a bunch of ones and zeros. Douglas and Whitney find a message left inside the virtual reality for Douglas by Hannon Fuller. And Douglas jacks into the virtual reality and ends up in the guise of a bank clerk called John Ferguson. He travels around the simulated Los Angeles, which is beautifully evoked in this film too. They do use some computer graphics in this that are used quite well. They still hold up fairly well in these days for the simulated Los Angeles. They have the streetcars there. They have the orange groves and country areas on the side. They really do evoke 1937 Los Angeles in a beautiful way. And in a lot of reviews I've seen of this movie, they don't really seem to appreciate the detail that's gone into with this one. It's a lovely piece of work, and it really does give a feel for Los Angeles as it was in the 1930s. One of the things that Douglas finds is that Fuller has used the likenesses of a lot of people he knows for the AI creations in this virtual reality, including Whitney. There's a bartender called Jerry Ashton who appears in the same form as Whitney. So you've got Vincent D'Onofrio in this movie in a dual role where he plays the kind of long-haired computer geek Whitney, plus he plays a very savvy and canny and cunning and quite ruthless bartender inside the virtual reality of 1937. So Douglas starts his investigation, and as things develop, he finds out that things aren't what they seem to be. When the policeman tries to find Fuller's daughter, he finds her, but she's not herself. She's actually a checkout chick in a supermarket, Natasha Molinaro, and she doesn't recognize Douglas or the cop. And so Douglas comes to the realization that his 1999 world is also a virtual reality. So you've got to kind of inception think about layers upon layers upon layers, and that his world is actually a simulation in a much larger world. And he eventually finds it out by driving to the edge of Los Angeles and finding that the world dopplers off into a wireframe graphic in the distance. And that's the kind of iconic image from the movie, which the trailer and all of the promotional material, including the DVD box cover, gives away. And it interestingly raises a whole bunch of existential questions. I mean, there's a lot of serious scientific study going into trying to work out whether our world is a simulation in a computer somewhere in a much larger universe. At the moment, they're leaning towards probably not, but you're never really going to know. And one of the fun things a lot of scientists are doing is trying to find ways of testing the hypothesis, testing whether our universe is a simulation or not. I don't know whether we're all living in a simulation or not. And to be honest with you, I don't really care that much because I'm doing my own thing. If we're living in a simulation, I just wish they had a program my particular character a little bit better and a little bit more tall, good-looking, rich, and probably with much better teeth. I mean, you can lean in the direction of thinking we're in a simulation by the very fact that Trump became president in the US, because it's probably the most chaotic thing you can imagine. And if you're running a simulation, you want to try something really gonzo now and then. I mean, it's like when you play SimCity and you let Godzilla loose in the city as a computer game, or you kind of try to trash your computer game by having tsunamis hit the simulation you're making. You want to test things to destruction. And there's an argument, if only by implication, that we're living in a computer simulation because of the chaotic nature of current geopolitical shenanigans. So this movie does raise some interesting questions. It was actually based on a somewhat different 1964 novel by a guy called Daniel F. Galloway, an American science fiction writer, called Simulacron 3. Now, Simulacron 3, and again, Wikipedia, is a story of a virtual city used for marketing research developed by a scientist to reduce the need for opinion polls. The computer-generated city simulation is so well programmed that although the inhabitants have their own consciousness, they are unaware that they are only electronic impulses in the computer. So that's the story of Simulacron 3. Now, there was a previous version of this done as well. This isn't the first roundabout for an adaptation of this novel. In fact, in 1973, there was a two-part German science fiction television series called World on a Wire, Welt am Draht, which I've actually watched the first half of, and it plays very more like the novel than it does like The 13th Floor. And it was, oddly enough, directed by Rainer Werner Fassbinder, the guy who directed Veronica Voss and Querelle and Lola and a lot of those kind of famous 1970s, 1980s German films, Berlin Alexanderplatz, for instance. But in 73, he made a version of this particular story. And it looks good. I mean, there's some really interesting use of music. There's interesting use of Marlene Dietrich's image and voice. And they've got a beautifully wonderful lot of set designs, which give you that kind of plasticky 1970s version of the future, which is kind of groovy looking. It's kind of in the mode of things like Space 1999 and UFO, the TV series. It's that kind of plasticky future. And it's a really interesting adaptation. I'm going to watch the rest of it just in a day or two. But if you can find World on a Wire, which you should be able to do, there was a Criterion edition of it as well. That's how well it's regarded. Then that's worth checking out on top of The 13th Floor. 13th Floor, of course, being a 1990s, 2000s kind of science fiction movie, it has to be an action flick. So there are a number of action scenes in there. There are some fights between Jerry Ashton, the bartender in the simulated 1937, and Douglas. There's a whole bunch of kind of shooting, fighting, people dying, all that kind of stuff in this movie, which is considered necessary for that kind of thing. Think piece science fiction movies end up on Netflix, and even then they'll want a lot of action in them. Oddly enough, it's a bit sad in some ways that science fiction has become a genre of action rather than of ideas in our kind of world. But there is room for cramming in some ideas as long as you chuck in the action. So I kind of like that. I like the fact that this movie is about ideas underneath the action stuff. It's very much of its time, and it looks very much of its time. Nothing dates so much as the future. And the slightly futuristic look of this film has kind of passed its use-by date. The machine that drops you into these virtual simulations is a whole bunch of green lasers fanning out over your body kind of thing. It doesn't get much more complex than that. Of course, there were budgetary limitations. Even in 1999, $16 million wasn't a large budget. And the box office was about $18.5 million. So it didn't make its money back, but only just, really. I remember it being all over video stores at the time. There were a lot of people renting the movie at the time because we wanted movies about ideas. I know that when I was going through looking at science fiction movies in video stores at the time, I could tell the meathead action ones, and I'd probably rent one of those. You know, you'd get to like $5 for $10 or whatever it was. But I wanted a couple of slightly meatier movies as well, so I'd rent something like The 13th Floor and be as entertained by the ideas as I am by the kind of visuals and the action. I should tell you my Matrix story while I'm on the subject too, just to digress a bit as I want to do. I saw The Matrix under some unusual circumstances. Back in 1999 or thereabouts, whenever The Matrix came out, there were these things you could get at the airport called mystery flights. And what the airlines would do, and this I think it was Qantas in this case, would do is you pay, I think it was $100, and you get a mystery flight to and from another city in Australia. If you're really lucky, it'd be Perth, and you get to stay there overnight and come back the next day, so you'd book a hotel for yourself. I was kind of hoping for Perth. I got Adelaide, which is only like 800 kilometres away. So, and I've only had like a 4 or 5 hour window in Adelaide before I had to come back on the flight they booked me on. So I got a bit ripped off by that. So here's what I did. I flew to Adelaide, went down to Glenelg on, down on the beachside part of things, and found I had about 3 hours to kill before I had to get back to the airport. So the cinema in Glenelg was showing The Matrix. So I went in and saw The Matrix, and I was deeply underwhelmed by it. Really didn't like it at all. I think Keanu Reeves is kind of lame in it. I know some friends who worked on the effects and kind of technical side of the movie who say that it was a lot of fun. Keanu was a nice guy, and I'm fully willing to believe that. But I never really got into the Matrix trilogy at all. So I watched The Matrix, went back to the airport in Adelaide and flew back to Melbourne. And that's The Matrix story, is basically I flew 800 kilometres to see it and was underwhelmed, which is kind of disappointing. If you're travelling 800 kilometres to see a movie, you want it to be something spectacular and something you'd enjoy, even though I didn't know I was flying there to see a movie, of course. But I've never done a mystery flight since then. I don't know if they still do them. I'm going to have to Google that. Just let me pause the recording here. I'm going to Google that for us. Hello, there's actually a website called mysteryflights.com.au, and you can fly out of Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane. $295 for a day flight, one night mystery flight $450, two night $550, three night $650, two night luxury package $795, and a three night luxury package $950. So, yeah, that's kind of a weird thing. Let me have a look at the destinations I've got here, because I'm intrigued by this now. I'm going off on a tangent, but what the hell. Adelaide, Alice Springs, you can go to Byron Bay, Brisbane, Coffs Harbour, Canberra, Cairns, Sydney, Townsville, Whitsundays. Can you go to Darwin? Yeah, you can go to Darwin. It'd be nice to go to Darwin just for a day trip. I could really handle that. Because I know people in Darwin, and I also know where the good coffee shops are. But anyway, back to the movie. Do I like and would I recommend The 13th Floor? Yeah, I would. I think that it's very much of its time, and there's been so many science fiction movies since then that have played with the ideas of virtual reality, and that really kind of, you know, they tend to blur into each other. The number of movies I've seen about AI in the last 5 years is phenomenal. And a lot of them aren't good. I mean, there are exceptions, movies like Her. But for the most part, no. But this one kind of stands out because of the third act, when Douglas finds out the nature of his reality. And he finds out that the Gretchen Mol character is actually from one further up the chain of simulations. Her name's Jane Fuller, and she lives in the year 2024, which doesn't look a lot like the 2024 we're going to know. It does look like there's been a little bit of global warming and some sea level rises, and it's quite a nice looking place to live. In fact, I wouldn't mind hanging out there for a while, but I don't think it's going to be like our 2024. But Douglas finding that out and finding out that his whole world's a lie is something that Craig Bierko does put across really well, as indeed does Dennis Haysbert's character, Larry McBain. There are a couple of other interesting actors in here as well. We do get Leon Rippey turning up as a lawyer, and Leon Rippey, you've seen in any number of things. You'll know his face if you kind of do a quick Google on him. So it's kind of nice seeing him in the film as well. But for the most part, yeah, the ideas are there, but I think that maybe with a slightly larger budget, they would have been able to convey them a lot more. But given the budget, the evocation of 1937 Los Angeles is sweet. The acting's on point. The characters are interesting, though I think that I keep looking into this because I'm doing more editing myself. There are places where I think the editing could have been a little bit tighter. But having said that, I enjoyed the film, rewatching it. Probably not going to rewatch it terribly much in the future. Maybe every now and then I might dip in when I'm not doing anything else. But it is worth checking out if you haven't checked it out. And if you haven't seen it since it came out in 1999, it might be a good revisit for you. So, yeah, it's definitely a recommended. So, anyway, I'm going to end the podcast here because I've got stuff to do. And I really want to get the episode out because of the delay I've had since the last episode. So I'd rather do a short one and get it out than wait and do a longer one and go into more detail on things and not put it out for another few days. I really want to get this episode out. And then, of course, next week I'm doing The Other Side of the Wind for Paleo Cinema Podcast. So, anyway, we'll leave it here. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being a part of things. Thank you again to the Patreon supporters and all the people who've said nice things about me delaying the podcast for a couple of weeks. I've kind of missed doing it. You get into a nice rhythm doing podcasts on a weekly basis, and then suddenly the rhythm's not there, and you kind of wander around with your hands in your pockets, kicking stones and wondering what the fuck you're going to do. But the Sydney trip was good for me. It was really fun in some ways, but it was kind of sad in the others. Visiting your mother when you know she's slowly and inevitably dying is not particularly pleasant. But I did make use of the time and found out that I can keep my own company for 9 days pretty well. Towards the end, I got lonely, but I did kind of okay with that. So anyway, look after yourselves. Watch some good movies. Watch some bad movies. Watch any fucking movie you like. I'll be back soon. And of course, here are the trailers in the style of movie trailers to see you through. And then I'm going to play some more 1960s Italian pop music just to kind of end things off. So you guys take care. I'll be back soon. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema Podcast and Martian Driving Podcast, done in the style of movie credits to honour the people who support this podcast. Thank you to Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the musical director, Jan, the dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, our wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Sullivan, our director of monster effects, Dylan, our goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Richard H, our set photographer, Mark D, our extra, and David L, our extra, Kerry H, who is the accountant, and our newest supporter, Gary J, who is a CGFX technician. So thank you very much to all of the supporters of the podcast. I really appreciate you dipping into your purses and helping out with the podcast.